وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته. Yes, dear listeners, inshallah ta'ala, today we will be continuing with our program on Muslim communities, and we are focusing on Islam in the Far East. And in the last segment, we began discussing Islam in China, which is where Islam first arrived in the Far East. Just to recap what we discussed in the last segment, we mentioned that Islam had arrived in China within the first century after the advent of Islam, and it was brought by some ambassadors of the Muslim Empire, possibly during the reign of Uthman radiallahu ta'ala anhu, possibly thereafter. Some say to Sa'ad bin Abi Waqqas radiallahu anhu, others reject that. Nevertheless, there were some Dashi or Tashi, which is the Chinese word for Arab, ambassadors who had arrived in China within the first 100 years and had invited the emperor of the Tang dynasty to Islam. So in the initial years of Islam in China, that is the 7th, 8th and 9th centuries, Islam was on a very small scale. Just a handful of Muslims had come there for trade and had begun residing there. And from the 10th century onwards, Islam began growing at a phenomenal rate. And the Nuiji Masjid in Beijing, built in 996, bears testimony to that. So Islam was on the rise from the 10th century, and 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 14th centuries, Islam became a very vibrant part of the Chinese society. And there were a number of Muslims all around China in the different trading cities on the Silk Route, as well as the ports on the coast of China. The Yuan dynasty was the ruling dynasty in the 13th, 14th centuries, and they were of mixed Mongol-Chinese roots and therefore were more liberal or open-minded in their outlook and in encompassing people of different races and cultures. And they in actual fact brought in hundreds of thousands of Muslims from Western and Central China, Central Asia, sorry. They were brought in to assist with the administration of the empire. There were people who were craftsmen, people who were doctors, engineers, different skilled people who were brought in to assist with the administration of the Yuan dynasty. In the year 1345, the very well-known Moroccan traveler Ibn Battuta rahmatullahi alayh, whom we have discussed in virtually every country that he had visited, he arrives in China. Now, just to recap, if those of us who can remember and rewind to our discussion on Islam in India, we mentioned that he was to be sent as an envoy from the Sultanate of Delhi to the Emperor of China. And the Sultan of Delhi had sent with him lots of different gifts, valuable gifts, expensive presents for the emperor. There were a few ships that were ready to set sail, but fate struck and all of those ships, all due to a storm, all of them sunk to the bottom of the sea and didn't even leave the coast of India. But for Ibn Battuta, who was a seasoned traveler, a trivial episode like this wasn't going to put him off, and he nevertheless made his way to China via Indonesia, Java, and then sailed up north to China. So in the year 1345, he arrives in China. And today, inshallah ta'ala, we will be discussing his notes that he made regarding his travels in China. So as usual, Ibn Battuta, when he arrives at a place, in his Rihla Ibn Battuta, in his book of his travels, he normally describes the geography of the place. And he begins explaining how fertile the land of China is, the area that he first arrives. He describes the different fruits and the different crops which is found in abundance. He also mentions that it's rich in mineral resources, in gold and silver as well. And he goes into a bit more detail regarding the fruits. He says that the sugar which is found in China is found in abundance, and in actual fact supersedes that of Egypt, which at that time was possibly one of the largest producers of sugar of the time. So he mentions that China even supersedes that. He mentions that there's also abundant grapes and pears, And he says that I used to always think that the Uthmani pears which are found in Damascus were matchless, they were unequaled, until he tasted those that are in the pears of China. And he describes other fruits as well. He speaks about the melons. And as we all know, the melons of Khawarizm and Isfahan of Uzbekistan and Persia are undoubtedly the best in the world as they still are today. And he says that even though they are the best, he says that the ones that he tasted in China would actually equal those that he had in Uzbekistan. So he speaks about the fruit and the crops, he speaks about the wheat and lentils which are found as well in China. He thereafter goes and speaks about the production, and he says that the earthenware and pottery production in China, which is found more so in the cities of Peking and Guangzhou, are really something to behold. And he says that they are made from a special type of clay, and after they are hardened, people would light a fire underneath them. Once they are hardened for 3 days, they would pour water over them to allow them to become mud once again. And thereafter, they would leave this mud to sit for over a month. And the ones that sit for a month are obviously the highest quality. And he says, despite being of such a high quality, they are similar in price to the ones we find in our country. And he says, this pottery is so well known that they are transported to India and to different countries of the world, and they even reach his country of Morocco. And he says, this is the best type of pottery which he has seen in his travels. He speaks about the Muslims in the different cities. And he says every city has a Muslim quarter where Muslims would be living in their own quarter. They would have their own masajid where they would perform salah together, and they are indeed very honored and respected by the Chinese. He also mentions how skilled the Chinese people are themselves, and he says they really take pride in their crafts and in their industries, and they are really the best at it. And he says that in terms of crafts and industries, this is well known, many people have written about it. But what the point that is overlooked by many writers or many travelers, he says, are the arts and paintings of the Chinese people. He says nobody can be as meticulous and detailed as the Chinese are, not even the Romans, he says. And he says that they are so detailed in their paintings. He gives an example. He says that whenever they would enter any city, himself and obviously a group of a few other people, they would pass through any city, the people would see these people as foreigners, and they would begin painting sketches of these foreigners. And he says one day we went to the city where the Sultan was, and on the way there we were all dressed in our Iraqi clothing, and we passed by the souq of the naqashin, the artists, and they go to the emperor's palace. And in the on their way back in the evening, when they are returning, he passes by the same souq of these artists, and his companions are really bewildered. They see their paintings on different walls which have been painted by these people in the souq. And he says that they are looking at one another in amazement, that they cannot even pinpoint any mistake in any of the paintings because they are done so well. So he says the people are really good at painting as well, not just at the different industries and crafts. He mentions, interestingly, that if any Muslim trader had to arrive in China at the time wanting to sell his goods or to purchase goods, they would have a choice. They could either stay at a hotel, or they could be the guest of one of the Muslim traders. And he says if they had to stay at the house of a Muslim trader, the Muslim trader would take responsibility of all the wealth of this guest, of this trader. And this expat who is now staying in China, this Muslim, he will look after him, spend on him for as long as he stays with him. And when the guest now intends to leave, then if there is any deficiency in the goods which he has brought, then the host will be responsible to pay for that, and he will gladly pay for that. And he says, even if he goes to a hotel, then he would give all his goods to the hotel owner, and he would be responsible for it, and the hotel owner will obviously keep a tab of whatever the payments are due to him, and he will buy for him whatever he wants, whether it's food, whatever he requires, he will look after him, and at the end of the stay, he will ask him to pay the bill, and he will also be responsible for the goods. So even going to stay in China as a trader was very easy. He says even if the Muslim trader who comes there intends to even get married there, the hotel owner will allow him and arrange for everything for him. During his travels, I'm just cherry picking just a few incidents which he mentioned in his book. He speaks about the city of Peking, which is known as Zaytun in those times to him, and he says they are very well known for their production of cloth. And he says once he goes there, initially he's just a guest and a normal a person who is now visiting, and you can say he's still in economy class. But when he meets a friend of his who had visited India, a Qadi, and who had known that he was actually supposed to be sent, or who was being sent by the Sultan of Delhi to the Emperor, he now grants him this extra luxury, and he is now given VIP status. So from economy class, he moves right into business class. And he sends a message to the Emperor informing him that an envoy has arrived in China from the Sultan of Delhi. And this obviously takes at least a month or so to reach the Emperor and for the reply to come. So Ibn Battuta, who doesn't really like wasting time, and he says, while we are waiting for the reply, I really want to see a lot of the country. Let me use my time constructively. And he asks his friend, would it be possible for you to arrange some boats or something of the sort, some conveyance for me to travel around to see some of the other cities? And he obliges, and he makes his way to the city of Saint Kalan or Canton, or as we know it as Guangzhou. And he says, he describes the city of Guangzhou, and he says that it is one of the largest cities and has some of the best markets. And the greatest or the largest market is that of the pottery market, the earthenware market. And as we mentioned earlier, he says these pottery, these productions make their way to the rest of the world, not only throughout China, but also to India, Yemen, and other places as well. And he speaks regarding the Muslims of Guangzhou, and he says that in certain areas, there are Muslim-only areas in Guangzhou, and they have their own Jami' Masjid, they have a Zawiya, they have a Souq. And he says, لَهُمْ قَاضٍ وَشَيْخٌ. They have their own Qadi, they have their own Shaykh Mufti. And he says, in every city in China, it's imperative that the Muslims have their own Mufti to whom they can refer their questions to, and as well as a Qadi who will be able to settle disputes amongst themselves. So you can just imagine how the Muslim community must have been thriving, having their own Jami' Masjid, their own Qadi, their own Mufti in every city. And he makes his way through different towns, and eventually he returns to Peking. And when he returns, he arrives just a few days before the reply from the emperor comes, and he is invited to go and meet the emperor in the city of Beijing. So now when this reply comes, he now moves from business class right to first class. And the people really lay it out for him, and he's now a guest of the emperor. And with all this pomp and splendor, he now moves through China, making his way to Peking. And he says they would وَسِدْنَا فِي الضِّيَافَ نَتَغَدَّى بِقَرْيَةٍ وَنَتَعَشَّى بِأُخْرَى. We would be the guests of so many people. We would stop for lunch in one town. We would be the guests there. We would have lunch there at some people's house. We'd carry on down the river because they were moving by ship, and we'd have supper, and we'd be the guests at another town at somebody else's house. And we were the guests wherever we went. And he says there are some of the places which are so beautiful, فَكَأَنَّهَا غُوطَةٌ. He says the one place he goes to is so beautiful, it's almost as beautiful as that of Ghouta. And Ghouta, we know, is the area just outside Damascus, which is really fertile, and unfortunately it's under siege at the moment, and obviously the war is carrying on. May Allah make it easy for our Muslim brothers and sisters who are in Syria. In any case, he says Ghouta, and Ghouta for travelers at the time was so beautiful, was that it was actually the litmus test against which all others can be tested. So he would use this example of Ghouta to explain something which was extremely beautiful. So he said this place was so beautiful, it was almost as beautiful as that of Ghouta. And on the travel, along the travels, he mentions an interesting incident. He says that one day I was sitting at the house, I was resting at the house of a friend of ours, and a large group of people came, and a person was introduced as Mawlana Qawamuddin As-Sabti. So he said that I was a bit surprised on hearing this name. It sounded somewhat familiar, as if I've heard this name before. And when the person enters, he looks at him, and he actually starts staring at him. So the person tells him that you're looking at me as if you know me. So he says, where are you from? He says, I am from Sabta. And Sabta is the name for Ceuta, which is C-U-E-T-A. It is actually today a Spanish colony on the tip, on the northern tip of Africa. So basically a small piece of land cut out of Morocco, that is a Spanish colony today. And this place of Ceuta is where this person has come from. And he says, well, I am from Tanger, I am from Tangiers, which is the same land. And they greet one another again, and they hug each other, and they really start crying. And he says, did you ever come to India? He says, indeed, I did come. And then he remembers that this was, he says, Ant al-Bashri, are you the same person who came and I had invited him? He says, indeed, I am the same person. At that time, the Sultan of Dahli, he had known this person to be a very great alim. He was a youngster at the time, he hadn't had any beard at the time, as Ibn Battuta mentions. But he says, he was min khaddaq al-talaba. He was one of the very intelligent students, and yahfadul mu'atta, he had memorized the kitab of mu'atta as well, of Imam Malik rahmatullah alayh. So the Sultan had insisted that he stays there, and he resides in India, and begin teaching the people, but he requested that he rather move forward on to China. And he made his way to China, and here Allah Ta'ala had blessed him with lots of wealth, and he says he owned so many different slaves, and so much of different wealth. So from the city he now moves on to the city of Hangzhou. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it is known as Hangzhou, and at the time it was known as Madinat al-Khamsa. And this city, he says, is a city which is made up of different smaller towns within it. So he says there's one large wall which surrounds the entire city, and in the center there are six different cities, and each one has its own wall surrounding it. And he says he was welcomed, the Qadi, the Shaykh al-Islam, they all come out of the city to come and welcome him, and a number of other Muslims as well. And he enters the first city, which is that of the soldiers. And they explain to him that there were 12,000 soldiers who were there. And like that, he goes into the different cities. He enters the city where the Yahud, the Nasara, and the Atarak are staying. He enters the city where the Muslims are staying. And he says that the markets are very much in order, just as they are in the lands of Islam. They have muadhins, they have everything else as people would be living in Muslim lands. And he says one of the very wealthy traders had made some land and some places waqf for the people. So there are many fuqara, many poor people who come to the city, and their needs are taken care of from this waqf. And he also mentions the other cities, which are also very beautiful, very large in size, and he mentions how he travels through these cities as well. And lastly, the last city that he comes to is that of Beijing. And this city of Beijing is known as the city of Khan Baliq, and it is known as Beijing today. And this, he says, is the largest city that he's ever seen in his travels. He says, obviously with their conveyances, it would take almost 3 days to cover the city from one end to the other. And He says it's not like in the division of the city is not in the same way that that the rest of the cities in China are. He says these ones here are basically divided or have their localities in the same way that the rest of the world have their different different suburbs and districts. So it wasn't like the previous city which he mentioned, where they would have six different cities within a city. He mentions that the palace of the emperor whom he is invited to see is right in the center of the city. And it's really an anticlimax for him because he finds chaos upon arrival. Just a few days before his arrival, there was some chaos in the empire. The emperor had gone out to fight a civil war between him and some of his extended family, and he is deposed and he actually killed, and people are now welcoming the new emperor. And basically, he says that he enjoyed his stay in China. He was a bit perturbed because of the paganism which he had witnessed, but otherwise he said it was a wonderful country to visit. So this was the travels of Ibn Battuta to China in the year 1345 during the Yuan dynasty. And inshallah ta'ala, in our next segment inshallah ta'ala, we will carry on discussing the history from the 1300s right till possibly, if we can get there, right till Islam in China today. جزاك الله خيرا والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته.